always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
All right, in a big diplomatic development in the Middle East, Ireland, Spain, and Norway are set to become the latest countries to recognize a Palestinian state in a historic move that's being celebrated by the Palestinian Authority and condemned by Israel.
In a coordinated move this morning, the leaders of all three countries announced they will formally recognize a Palestinian state on May 28th. 143 UN member countries recognize Palestine as a state. The U.S. is not one of them. Speaking earlier, the Irish Prime Minister said the move was long overdue and an important step to achieving peace in the Middle East.
Today, Ireland, Norway, and Spain are announcing that we recognize the state of Palestine.
4:07, and welcome into the Tim Jones and Chris Harb Show. My partner speaker, Tim Jones, is once again in Washington, D.C. in the swamp. But joining me today and tomorrow is Susie Moore, Deputy Managing Editor at RedState.com. Susie, how are you?
I'm good, Chris, and thank you for getting my title back.
I do. I was like,
you did a
really,
great job.
I was very, very conscious of it. I was rehearsing coming in today, so I didn't screw it up.
I just need an easier title.
Exactly.
Like,
I tell you what, remove the deputy.
Yeah, but then that
somebody's
would,
still, but yeah.
There is already a managing
editor. All right,
editor.
All right. And I know you're not the walk over people, to walk yeah. over type of person.
I wouldn't
anyway.
Do that
and on the wheels of steel, the coolest man in radio, Joey V. Vasevich. How are you, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you for getting my title correct. That's the exact way I want it said.
You did.
Coolest cat in radio, in charge of the wheels of steel, managing editor of the Tim Chris Show.
You are. I mean, Joey, I just wanted to say this. Joey, when we do the remotes and at mm-hmm. the different locations, Joey sets up all the tech for that.
Yep.
And I would be a nervous wreck knowing that the fate of the station and the show depends on me getting all this stuff together. And he's always just a cool cucumber. We can be at Jefferson City, at the Capitol. We can be at Johnny's. We can be at Espino's. Cool guy. Joey, you should have been in that commercial, Never Let Him See You Sweat, because mm-hmm. that's you, my friend.
The unflappable Joey V.
The unflappable Joey V.
I can do MacGyver stuff, too. If you got any bombs sitting around the house.
There you go.
I'll take care of them.
Little handyman stuff.
Of course.
You want Craigslist, or well, not Craigslist, or what do they call that?
Angie's,
but they've changed it to something.
It's just called Angie now. It's
just Angie now. Hey, you heard that clip coming in there. Norway, Spain, and another country are recognizing Palestine. I want to get into that, the significance of that, especially with Spain. I mean, you remember the history of that. Spain was responsible centuries ago, I think what they call the Spanish Inquisition, where they were trying to drive all of the Jews out of Spain. I think, and I know that's hundreds of years ago, but I think it's just a bad look for Spain to sign on to that. But before we get to that, Susie, I want to talk about last night. My wife and I had the honor of attending the Vitae dinner last night, and the guest speaker was Seth Dillon of the Babylon Bee.
Mm-hmm.
He did not disappoint. It was a very, very good speaker. It was very humorous, and I guess you'd expect that
sure.
from the Babylon Bee. But I put this on my Facebook page today. I think Seth Dillon had the quote of the night, the quote of the year to me. And he said, quote, "Calling abortion women's health care is the same thing as calling rape lovemaking." And, you know, it's in your face, and I understand that. But, you know, people, when they call women's health care, when they call abortion a women's health care, they are trying to soften it and not to give you the connotations of what abortion really is. And I think the connection or the comparison of lovemaking to rape kind of shows that contrast very well to me. And it really struck me.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a jarring comparison to make, and I mm-hmm. think it was by design to do that.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, calling abortion women's health care completely erases the fact that what it is doing is extinguishing the life of
yeah.
another
yeah.
Human being in the process. And it does gloss over what is not really a, well, what is an ugly thing. So I you know, if it wakes somebody mm-hmm. up, okay.
Got to give a shout out to Brandy Meeks over mm-hmm. at the Vitae Foundation. We were fortunate to have her on the show a couple, 2-3 weeks ago out of Johnny's when I did our remote. She was with us. She and her organization are doing a phenomenal job. They had speakers that were there speaking before Seth Dillon, talking about all of the things that they do of trying to help mothers that are in right. that situation. But also what I love is, you know, the 21st Act aspect of it is, hey, you're trying to drive public opinion. You're trying to change hearts and minds.
Sure.
And they're using political tools, marketing tools that you would use to sell a product, in a sense, to gauge hearts and minds, to change people's hearts and minds on abortion. It was, I think them and Thrive and a lot of organizations like Our Lady's Inn, who my good friend Connie Eller retired from there forever. I think those organizations all around the state of Missouri are doing a fantastic job. And I think that's why abortion, besides the law, but abortions are just about zero happening here in Missouri, and those organizations have to take a lot of credit for that.
They should, and I think that's critical to remember, because in all likelihood there is going to be an abortion issue on the ballot.
Yes, yes.
Compliments of the fact that we weren't able to get IP reform taken care of. So, yeah, I mean, we're going to have to. Those of us who are in the pro-life camp are going to have to continue to sell. Well, you wouldn't think it would be hard to sell life.
Yeah,
I mean. Not life insurance. Life. you would think that would actually be exactly the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's an uphill battle from a messaging mm-hmm. standpoint. So the more you have organizations like Thrive and Vitae that are doing what they are doing and are able to show mm-hmm. to the community how they are coming in and supporting mothers and families, that's really critical to what they're doing.
Susie, let's stay local here, and we'll continue to talk about children or young people. The girl that was charged in the beating in Hazelwood East a few months ago of that young girl, judges ruled that she will not face adult charges, that she will stay in the juvenile court. I know you did not practice juvenile criminal law, but your overall 30,000 foot thoughts on this as an attorney.
So I was not, I am not privy to all of the details of the factors that were considered or that are normally considered in making that determination. I know she, you know, both girls were 15,
yes.
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have seen some people assert that the girl who ultimately was injured so badly, maybe in this particular situation, maybe she, you know, played a role in things getting, you know, escalating between the two of them.
Right.
I don't know that that's the
right.
case. I just know I've seen people making that, that accusation. But I guess I am very conflicted on this, because
sure.
when you see the video of what happened, it's horrendous, and it is kind of hard to even fathom treating somebody who's willing to be that violent and that, you know, I mean, at the point when that was happening.
What about the argument that, you know, the psychologists will make that your brain at that age is not fully developed, and you don't have the capacity as an adult would have to stop yourself from committing harm like that? You know, that's what scientists, that would be introduced, I'm sure.
Correct. And that would be mm-hmm. an argument in favor of keeping her as a juvenile or trying her as a juvenile. You know, I think at a certain point, the degree of the harm caused plays a role in yeah. making that determination. And I would also say that if you're worried about the people's developments of their brains, you should probably be worrying about bashing them mm-hmm. in.
What would you say now? You know, there's a lot of propaganda going around during that, where people were saying this and that. We really don't know what the ultimate truth was, but,
right.
you know, the young girl's family was saying she spoke 5 languages. She was on the honor roll. She was in the band and all of this. Can you make a credible argument that maybe in the heat of the moment, this person, as a young person whose brain and everything is not fully developed, lost their cool, hurt this person severely, but do you damage a person's life, maybe permanently, who, according to the reports, had so much to potentially offer society? Can you say, yes, I made a mistake, you're going to have to pay some type of penalty before for this, but we're not going to give you the type of penalty that could maybe permanently stain your life.
I think you can almost always make a compelling argument for grace. I think you can, in mercy. And particularly with a young person, if there's an opportunity that person can be rehabilitated and, you know, encouraged to lead a positive life and a productive life, I think that that's something that you should look closely at. I guess I will say I'm having trouble squaring somebody with that much potential and, you know, all those things going for them, defaulting to such a violent response to something. It doesn't really square for me. It seems like there's something missing. That doesn't mean that those factors shouldn't be considered. And again, like I said, I think there should always be room for an argument for grace. And honestly, if at the end of the day, the young girl who was injured is able to recover and the young girl who was the perpetrator in this instance is able to, you know, go through the legal process and find a way to turn her life or to turn what happened into a positive and become a, you know, productive citizen. I guess that's the best outcome you can hope for. Mm-hmm. But I certainly understand why people are concerned about her not being tried as an adult, given the severity of the situation.
Susie, Donald Trump and Joe Biden have wrapped up their nominations months ago. So people aren't really paying too close to elections, but yesterday was election day in part of the country. Cut one. Joey, I want to play this, and then I got some questions for you, Susie.
The Fulton County District Attorney, Fonnie Willis, has survived a primary challenge from fellow Democratic opponent Christian Wise Smith, a local attorney. Willis cruised to a dominant victory. Dominant. She'll now square off against Republican challenger Courtney Kramer in November. So despite all the controversy surrounding her, it seems like Fonnie Willis will somehow keep her job. I say somehow not because she's prosecuting for President Donald Trump in Georgia, but because she almost derailed the case.
Susie, this is one of those things where you can say, hey, check us out here in St. Louis. We had Kim Gardner. We're wondering how the hell did she get reelected with her record? Is it kind of the same situation here with Georgia, Fulton County being as Democratic as it is? And she can play the victim, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can ask, you know, what is going on in these communities where you've got somebody who is basically objectively shown to be horrific at their job, and yet they still have, you know, draw that much support. Now, I don't know what the final vote totals were. I don't know how heavy the turnout was in Fulton County. You have to believe that because the presidential nomination is a done deal, there's probably not. I mean, the people that come out and vote in a primary when you don't have, you know, some of the higher ticket offices on the ballot are very dedicated partisans.
Right.
So I'm sure there is a healthy contingent of people, of voters in Fulton County, who feel that Fonnie Willis has been being picked on by the Republicans and by Donald Trump's camp, and it's because she's a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
So them coming out to show support for her, I guess, is understandable. I don't know anything about her opponent in the primary, so I don't know whether, you know, I don't know how good of a competitor he was.
Susie, the trend on the left coast of the lefties kind of waking up a little bit and getting rid of these leftist prosecutors and these left-wing administrators seems to be continuing. We saw what happened in San Francisco where they eliminated their Soros prosecutor. We saw in Oregon, and I forgot what city it is, but it's Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt. He's losing 57% to 43% to a moderate gentleman named Nathan Vasquez, who was actually one of Schmidt's former deputies. Vasquez was a former registered Republican until he dropped his affiliation, quote, to disgust with Trump's rise. But we're seeing in Oregon there, the district attorney in one of the big cities, I forgot which one it is losing their big time, and centrist candidates prevailed in a pair of Democratic primaries in the Portland area U.S. House seats. One of them was Primea Jayapal, who's part of the caucus there. Her sister was running for a seat in Oregon. She got slammed big time. So Are they waking up there on the left, or they just see this crime and it's affecting them now, and we got to do something about it?
I don't know if you can make a broader extrapolation from it. Multnomah County is Portland, and Portland
is
has
that
had
it is?
Yeah,
okay.
And Portland has had it's more than its fair share of unrest and issues. And so, if there's a viable alternative in the race that you know maybe presents as more moderate but also as more competent, that doesn't shock me. Although it is Portland, and you expect them to be very, you know, kind of skewed to the progressive. Well, I'm just saying, you know, I mean, the bottom line is there may be more Portland residents who aren't as on board with the far left progressivism than as we thought. But I don't know that you can take from that that's a trend that we're going to see nationwide. I think that might be Multnomah County specific.
And before we wrap up this segment, of course, we opened the segment talking about Norway, Spain, and another country.
Ireland.
Ireland, yes. Mm-hmm. Recognizing the Palestinian Authority. I guess they are the leaders of Palestine. Your thoughts on that, Susie? Are you surprised any of those that those countries did that?
I can't say I'm surprised because we've seen, particularly since October 7th, this sort of disheartening trend of countries and you know United Nations members and also in universities kind of coming down and being against Israel. The thing that's because Israel is responding to having been attacked.
Sure.
The thing that's really I don't understand is, you know, the two-state solution has been on the table before multiple times and has been rejected by the Palestinians, as I understand it.
Yes.
So why, after Hamas attacked and viciously, brutally murdered 1,200 Israelis in October, is there essentially this idea that, well, we should go ahead and give in and give them something that they wouldn't accept before in response to that? I don't understand that.
I don't either. I think it just comes down basically as a hatred for the Jews. You don't want them to have a country. You really don't want them to exist on the planet. I think that's the ultimate aim for these people. Maybe not so much these countries. They have ulterior motives to that. But I think some of the anti-Semitism that we're seeing around the world, especially on these campuses, is, of course, a misunderstanding of the situation because they're being brainwashed and fed propaganda. But I think also it's just a visceral hatred of Jewish people because of who they are, the quote-unquote God's chosen people, and because of the phenomenal success that they've acquired as a people in every almost industry. They are very, very successful and have a hand in it. So, interesting conversation. Thank you there, Susie. Hey, when we come back, we'll speak with Zach Smith, our senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. We'll talk to him about the Trump trials, and I want to ask him about this AI situation with Scarlett O'Hanson and the legal implications of that. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Scarlett Johansson calls out OpenAI CEO Sam Altman for allegedly using a voice in its artificial intelligence software that she believes sounds like her own without her consent. She says in a statement the businessman sent her an offer in September to hire her as the voice of the ChatGPT 4.0 system, but she turned it down. She says, quote, "He said he felt that my voice would be comforting to people. After much consideration and for personal reasons, declined the offer." However, Johansson accuses the company of going ahead with it by using a voice that, quote, "sounded like me." Mr. Altman even insinuated that the similarity was intentional, tweeting a single word, "her," a reference to the film in which I voiced a chat system, Samantha, who forms an intimate relationship with a human.
4:30 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show, and our next guest, he hangs out with the Hollywood crowd. Let's get his thoughts on this and the Trump trial and other legal matters.
Oh, it's all.
Zach Smith, legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation.
You know, I ask you a lot of predictions. Can you predict what the Supreme Court probably will do with this action? Zach, welcome to the show. When I meant Hollywood, I meant Hollywood, Florida. I know you live there in Florida, right? That's the Hollywood crowd you hang out with?
Absolutely. Although I'm a little far away from Hollywood, but it's much better than the West Coast Hollywood.
Excellent. Zach, we got Susie Moore, Deputy Managing Editor of Red State, with us today. Tim is out, and I will start the first question. You heard that clip there about the lawsuit that Scarlett Johansson is going to sue. She says AI is stealing her voice. There's an interesting case here. Sarah Silverman and George R.R. Martin and John Grisham, they are suing AI because they used the memoirs that they read, the stories that they read. AI was used to train a voice on their voices. But with Johansson, they hired a actress that sounded like her and using that voice as the AI. Does Johansson have a case here?
Well, I need to know more information about this, but look, I think
in fact, that was a 3-minute question. I gave you all the information.
Now, I don't believe that for a second, Chris. I feel like it's a setup here. I don't know. But, in all seriousness, look, I think this is a somewhat novel area of law. There are laws on the books in many states, or kind of common law type claims that people can bring for casting, you know, a false light or misappropriation of image. And so to a certain extent, what we're talking about, we'll be applying those very old, very well established concepts to this new context. What is interesting, as you mentioned, though, are the instances where there is not an actual human person involved, where solely the process of AI and machine learning and, you know, machine generation of voices that are being used. And I suspect you'll see some of this as well with certain holographic images that are starting to come to the forefront and this sort of thing as well. But I think it goes without saying, we are in a brave new world in terms of what AI can do in replicating someone's voice or image or even their likeness in terms of pictures and holograms and that sort of thing as well.
Speaking of brave new worlds, Zach, I assume that you've probably been following the Trump trial in Manhattan.
Oh, yes.
I certainly have, too. And as I was saying, I'm kind of glad it wasn't televised, because otherwise I would have done nothing else the past 6 weeks. But so now that the evidence is done, they had the jury instruction conference yesterday afternoon. I haven't really had a chance to digest that conference, other than I got the distinct impression that Judge Merchan ruled primarily for the prosecution and not the defense. Big surprise. I've been trying to discuss this with other people and saying, you know, no matter how good a case you think you may have on appeal, no matter how great of a record you may have made, you want to win outright with the jury if you can.
100%.
I don't know. What is your overall takeaway, having kind of observed this from afar and knowing that it's going to go to the jury next week?
Well, look, I think we have to keep in mind this is an incredibly unfavorable jury to Donald Trump. It's there in Manhattan. I think at the outset of the trial, everyone was pretty convinced that he was going to be convicted just because of the jury pool that was being pulled to hear this case. Now, after hearing the 6 weeks of testimony, particularly the testimony of Michael Cohen, which was really the linchpin of the prosecution's trial. They relied on him to make that connection that they needed to make to essentially bootstrap those misdemeanor bookkeeping charges into the felony charges, because the bookkeeping charges were supposedly made to further or hide another felony offense, although we're not still exactly sure what that other felony offense
is. It's kind of nebulous, isn't it?
It's incredibly nebulous, which creates its own issues, which if you're interested, we can talk about in a minute. But look, I think, you know, certainly after hearing the testimony, hearing the case, I don't think Alvin Bragg has met his burden of proof to prove his charges beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think, I don't know if there will be an outright acquittal, but I think it certainly is within the realm of possibility that there could be a hung jury, meaning that the 12 jurors cannot come to a unanimous decision on whether to convict or acquit.
Speaking with Zach Smith, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast. Zach, as you know, the left has really trained their fire on Justice Alito. The latest salvo they fired at him was, he decided to sell his stock after Budweiser, AB, started going southward. Because he sold stock, that makes him some type of villain. And the story that really got a lot of attention about Judge Alito's wife, hung a flag upside down outside of their home on January January 6th. Judge Alito claims he didn't know anything about it. It apparently occurred because of a spat between Justice Alito and a neighbor. Lindsey Graham has said, quote, we ought to take a good look at this. Mitt Romney and Bob Cassidy said, obviously, the optics are terrible. Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, said the panel should investigate. Dick Durbin, the chair, said he doesn't plan to do it, but he hopes Alito recuses himself from Trump-related cases. Long question, but your thoughts?
Chris, this is two long questions in a row. I need a short, punchy one after this. Look, I think this is much ado about nothing. I think many on the left have made very clear they're going to engage in a full court press against conservative justices, particularly the very outspoken ones like Justice Alito and Justice Clarence Thomas. And it's ironic, there are several well-known liberal judges and justices on the Supreme Court that their spouses have their own views, engage in their own careers, and yet you never hear anything about the need for their spouse on the court or the lower courts to recuse themselves from hearing cases. You only hear that in terms of Justice Alito and Justice Thomas. And I think to some extent, it's unfortunate that you had the GOP senators, including Senator Graham, Senator Romney, among others, kind of giving credence to this attack that many on the left are engaging in against Justice Alito and Justice Thomas and other conservative members of the court. And so to that extent, I would say, you know, hold the line. Don't give in to these politically motivated attacks, because it seems pretty obvious, if you look at it fairly and impartially, that that is what this is, an attempt to bully these conservative justices into recusing themselves from several high-profile, very important cases where they otherwise wouldn't have grounds or the need to do so.
Zach, I mean, in my observation over the past 30 years with Thomas and quite a while with Alito, I don't think either one of them is really likely to be bullied out of into recusing themselves unless they feel they genuinely have a conflict and that it's appropriate. But one of the concerns I have is that barring that, what it will be used for is to delegitimize any of the decisions that come out of the court that are close right. decisions. And, you know, right. we're seeing that more and more. And I know that Justice Roberts and the court are doing their darndest to kind of hang on to the integrity of the institution. And they've issued, you know, quite a few decisions already this year that were unanimous. And you see them still trying to maintain that integrity. But, I don't know where we go next if all we're going to do is attack every decision that they make.
Yeah, it's a great question, Susie. And look, I agree with you. I don't think Justice Alito or Justice Thomas will be bullied into recusing themselves. I do think that is part of the attempt, though, or if they won't recuse, to do exactly what you said, undermine the legitimacy of the decision and make the process so painful for Justices Alito or Thomas that, you know, I think many on the left would like to see them retire early, or potentially send a message to other conservative or conservative-leaning justices on the court and say that if you take the very strong constitutionally oriented positions that Thomas and Alito have taken, you too and your family too will also face this type of treatment. Don't forget as well, Susie, this message is not being lost on lower federal court judges, lawyers, and law students who may themselves one day be interested in taking the bench. And so I think this is a much more nefarious play in some sense than what we're seeing immediately in front of us. Don't forget as well, this could potentially be used as fodder for the left's attempt to pack the court, increase the number of justices on the court, to impose onerous restrictions on some of the types of cases the court could hear, and more of the left's radical agenda to basically, you know, quote, reform the courts. And so I think it's something worthwhile to watch. But I think it's important to call this treatment out for what it is, an attempt to smear the conservative justices because they are taking legal positions that those on the left do not like.
We're speaking with Zach Smith, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast. Zach, speaking of one of the most conservative justices, Clarence Thomas is certainly one of them, but he authored a decision last week that kind of has conservatives scratching their head. It was a 7-2 decision where he rescued basically the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from a near-death experience shooting down a challenge to its funding. Please explain to us what this is all about, sir.
Yeah, so this was a challenge to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's, the CFPB's, funding mechanism. The Constitution has the appropriations clause in it, basically saying that Congress has to appropriate money from the National Treasury for different programs and entities and agencies in order for them to be able to function. Well, in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, Congress tried to get clever. They wanted to insulate this new agency they created, the CFPB, from kind of the hum and drum of ordinary politics. And they, so they created a very unique funding mechanism for it. Instead of it having to receive annual appropriations from Congress, like almost every other federal agency, it instead is able to essentially draw on a line of credit almost from the Federal Reserve system, not to exceed 12% of the Federal Reserve's annual budget. And so the CFPB, shouldn't come as a surprise, has passed a host of rules and regulations in a lot of areas. And in a recent challenge to one of the CFPB's rules, the challenger said that this unique funding mechanism violated the Constitution's appropriations clause. And so in this decision that came out, Justice Clarence Thomas, as well as six of the other justices who joined them, said that it did not. He pointed to the text of the appropriations clause, some historical analogies that the early Congress has used in funding different entities. But Justice Alito, joined by Justice Neil Gorsuch, vehemently denied it. They said the text and the history actually pointed in the opposite direction. And frankly, I think Justice Alito had the better argument in this case. But I do think this case goes to show that the originalists on the court, the conservatives on the court, are not the monolithic block that so many on the left often paint them to be. I think it's also interesting to note that Justice Elena Kagan, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson also joined in this majority decision written by Justice Thomas. And so it is not, as the left would want us to believe, true that the conservatives always vote the same way on each and every decision. And I think this case illustrates that point very well.
Clarence ain't selling out, is he, Zach?
Absolutely not. He's not. Look, even Justice Scalia, who is a line of conservative justices, had several very bad decisions during his tenure on the court. And so I do think, as I said, Justice Alito had the better legal reasoning, the better opinion in this case. But time will tell whether or not that will his view will come to prevail in future cases.
Zach, speaking of the Supreme Court, tomorrow is another decision hand down day, and I know we are, well, I guess we're turning the corner into late May, so I guess we're going to start to see the pace of decisions being issued pick up just a little bit because they've got, what, 38 left, I want to say?
We would hope so. Otherwise, the last few weeks in June, we will be drinking from a fire.
Exactly. It will be impossible to keep up with them. I know there's no way to predict, you know, which ones are going to come down when, but I guess, do they usually save the most controversial ones for last?
That can be the case. Obviously, we have the Trump immunity case that has yet to be handed down. There's a case called SEC versus Torchese that involves the power of the SEC to hear cases in their in-house tribunals. There's several very big, very important First Amendment cases still outstanding as well. The NRA versus Volvo case, can states essentially penalize insurance companies and banks and other regulated entities for doing business with certain disfavored groups like the NRA is in the state of New York. And then also we have the net choice cases out of Florida and Texas where the court's being asked to decide whether and to what extent states can prohibit social media companies from deplatforming individuals because of their views. We haven't had a SCOTUS 101 episode the past 2 weeks. And so if folks go to my Twitter at TV Smith, I posted a very short clip outlining what some of these big decisions still outstanding are and what the results the court reaches, what the impact of those decisions could be.
Zach, we've been doing this show for so long, we have like a mind meld, because that was going to be my next question. Was there a SCOTUS 101 podcast for Friday? And you melded that into Susie's question or an answer to her question. So very good, sir. Zach Smith, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of SCOTUS 101 podcast. Zach, thank you so much for your time, sir. And we'll speak with you again next Wednesday.
Excellent. Always a pleasure. Great to talk to you guys this afternoon, and look forward to talking with you next week.
Thanks, Zach. Stay out of the Hollywood crowd, too. 507, we'll speak with Tim Jones from Washington, D.C. He will call in, and we've got a candidate coming in the studio, Susie, Tim Baker, candidate for lieutenant governor. He will join us. He is actually the Franklin County clerk, and he works on keeping elections safe there in Franklin County. We'll speak with them about his race for the nomination for Republican lieutenant governor here in Missouri. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL. Chris's Corner is next.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Then is the White House's message to those Americans who did not attend college for a variety of reasons, perhaps, including perhaps that they didn't want to take on all the debt that went with it right now, that they feel like in some form they are responsible for allowing those who did not to pay their fair share.
So look, here's the thing. This is a president who has been very clear about making sure that he's building an economy that leaves no one behind, right? Making sure that...
Left behind the ones who didn't get support because they didn't go to college?
I hear your question, but this is... If you look at what the president has done all holistically over the past 3.5 years, he has tried to build an economy for everyone.
451 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. And Susie, I want to ask you, what does it mean to build an economy holistically? What exactly does that mean? What is building an economy holistically?
Well, I think it means you use Legos and Lincoln Logs. And yeah, I don't know. She doesn't know. That's the thing.
Exactly. And that leads me to Chris's Corner.
Chris.
And if you don't know, now you know.
And now, Chris's Corner.
KJP Karan Jean-Pierre is arguably the worst press secretary that I've ever seen in my lifetime, and I have watched and have seen a lot of them. She is over her head in the job. She is not qualified to have the job, and as we've seen many, many times, if it wasn't for that binder in front of her, she would be completely lost. You know, as the leader of the communications shop, you know, her example probably filters down to the staff as well. We've seen many times where President Biden has made mistakes or on the campaign trail reading the teleprompter. We saw the example the other day where he said he read pause here, and it shows to me and to all of us that this man is declining while he is in office. But you know, it may not be all of Joe Biden's fault. A report came out today in Axios in an official transcript of a speech that Biden gave to the NAACP. His remarks were 10 words where the president made factual and pronunciation errors. Mr. Biden started the speech by telling the crowd that he was vice president during the pandemic, and President Obama had dispatched him to Detroit to help fix it. He then talked about meeting the city's mayor. In fact, Joe Biden misread that off the teleprompter, but that's what they put in the teleprompter, the wrong information. Joe Biden was actually there as vice president, and he was there to fix, quote unquote, the recession. He later told the crowd at the NAACP dinner that he was humbled to receive this organization, when actually he was there to receive an award. That wasn't Biden making a mistake on his own. He was reading what the transcript said was organization. The people that are writing President Biden's speeches are putting wrong words into this man's teleprompter. Quote, the corrected transcript crosses out organization and corrected it to say award. At one point, Mr. Biden boasted that his administration is cracking down corporate landlords who keep rent down. This was fixed to the opposite meaning with the correction reading that the Biden administration was cracking down on corporate landlords to keep rent down. You would think that if you have a job in the communication shop in the White House, that you would be a top speech writer, you would be a top person that knows how to spell, you know how to put the right meanings in words. In another sense, Mr. Biden denounced the January 6, 2021 riot at the Capitol, calling those who participated erectionists. And we all laughed about that because it's like, oh, it shows how old Joe Biden is. He's saying erections and all that. That was actually how it was spelled into the teleprompter. It was spelled IRRECTINISTS. It was later corrected to insurrectionist. Mr. Biden claimed that his expansion of the Affordable Care Act saved families $800,000 in premiums. He quickly corrected himself in mid-speech to $80,000. However, neither number was accurate, according to the corrected transcript. These people are putting in the wrong information for the President of the United States. Finally, smaller corrections in the transcript included Mr. Biden saying inspiressing, INSPIRESING, instead of inspiring, NAAC instead of NAACP, and one instance of saying have instead of are. An analysis of White House transcripts by the Daily Caller last month revealed that the White House communication staff has had to correct Mr. Biden's public remarks at least 148 times since the start of the year. They are correcting remarks that he spoke because he read it the way that they put it in the teleprompter. Boy, this is a sad indictment of KJP. She's already the worst press secretary that I've ever seen. And I'm sure as the head of the communications department, she also hires the people that on her staff. And you would think that at that level, they would have spell check or Grammarly or something so they could.
An editor
or something. There you go. You probably have a little soft spot for editors there. Editors to edit the president's speeches. And that is Chris's Corner. What do you think of that, Susie? I mean, they're putting their misspelled words and the wrong phrasing into the president's speeches.
Are they saying that every time he misspoke in that speech
because of the
teleprompter being wrong, yes, as opposed to them just correcting it in the transcript later?
No, they're saying that they had to correct it in here. My understanding is it was misspelled incorrectly and words were incorrectly in the...
I'm going to have to look at that story because I'm going to call BS if that's what they're saying. Now, do I believe that occasionally something gets put in the teleprompter incorrectly? Sure. But I would be willing to bet that the vast majority of those 148 times you just mentioned, mm-hmm, are Joe misspeaking the transcript, transcribing, mm-hmm, that, and then them going back and changing it later to show what he meant. Not him, mm-hmm, not him reading the teleprompter.
Well, that's still a good Chris's Corner anyway. But anyway,
I think there's fault to go around.
I want to throw Joe under the bus. I may have looked at it wrong. Thank you for correcting me there, Susie. Because I think you are right. Speaker stump speech 507 and Tim Baker, Lieutenant Governor candidate, will be in studio with Susie and I. You are listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL, number one for live and local conservative talk.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.